Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Can the president help to simplify and make more practical and less terrifying the application process for college and the costs of a higher education?
Higher education cannot be a luxury. It's an economic imperative. Every American family should be able to afford to get it.
The president is touring some college towns with solid institutions that may get overlooked by families driven by competition, Ivy League reputations, and the dizzying array of college media rankings, everything from most prestigious college to best quality college to best sports programs to best party school, many, many more. Over the last three decades, the average tuition at a four-year college has tripled. Students who take out loans graduate with an average of $26,000 in debt. Obama's plan would link federal aid to educational outcomes through a new college rating system, an index that would rank schools according to tuition, graduation rates, and debt. Schools with high rankings would get more affordable loans and larger federal grants.
Colleges that keep their tuition down and are providing high-quality education are the ones that are going to see their taxpayer funding go up.
President Obama wraps up his tour today with a visit to Binghamton University in New York and a final stop at Lackawanna College in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Joining us now from Binghamton is Catherine Dura, who will be a senior at Binghamton High School this year. She's already started her college search along with her father, Dr. Paul Dura. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
So how do you view this terrifying prospect of higher education? I gather it hits you in the wallet, Dr. Dura. Is that right?
It certainly does.
And when you think about, I want my daughter to get into a great school, do you even think about the money part? Does the ranking issue, the question of the quality school come first, and then you look at the sticker shock and see what it is you've dreamed of here?
I think naturally one is going to think about the schools and the quality and the name and initially, just like when shopping for a car. But then, yes, there will be the sticker shock when one realizes how much the prices have changed since I was going through the process, for example. But it does factor in. It certainly plays a role.
Catherine, what do you think in terms of your college future? Do you think finances or do you think sort of quality education, the kind of experience you want to have, or do you want a guarantee of a job when it's all over with?
I mostly look for what kind of programs they have and how strong they are, but then usually that translates to internships, so maybe getting my foot in the door for a future job.
Do the rankings have anything to do with your ability to get internships, connect with actual employers?
I would assume they do, yes.
But can you tell? I mean, what's the school that you're looking at right now, and what do the rankings tell you, if anything, about your actual post-college likelihood of getting a job?
I've been looking at University of Pennsylvania, for example, and I know that they have many strong internships, especially for strong students who show initiative. I would hope that that would lead to a job because I know many students take their internships and use that to go into fields that they would like to do in the future.
Catherine, when you think about your friends and family members the prospect of an Ivy League education, what does your experience tell you there? Good idea? Bad idea?
It seems to be a good idea, but then at the same time, you have to remember how much it costs since there are no scholarship or merit-based aid whatsoever.
Do you know someone who's having that experience right now?
Yes, I do. I know a few seniors who are going to Ivy Leagues.
And the costs are just mind-boggling, right?
Oh, yes. Their families are very stressed about how they're going to afford it.
Is that fair for families to have to go through that kind of stress at a moment that just a generation ago was just kind of pure joy, right, Doctor?
Oh, I wouldn't say it was pure joy, but it is a stressful time. And I think it was stressful, you know, several years ago when I went through it, and it's always stressful. The cost has always been an issue, but perhaps now it's even more so because of the huge increased rates of tuition, you know, above that of the rate of inflation.
But I certainly don't remember going off to school feeling like I was closing a mortgage.
Right, that's true. But certainly there's always a loan that were necessary even back when. And certainly the amount of debt that students are coming out with now is a lot higher than it was back then, I believe.
As a doctor and as someone who tries to investigate outcomes, is it easy for you to determine the performance of schools on criteria that matter to you and your daughter, ability to get employment, income potential, ability to pay off the debt, ability to network within a group of people who might end up hiring you, that sort of thing?
It's very difficult to ascertain that when looking at colleges online, when attending even the college information days and tours that are available, there isn't data for that, or at least good data. Certainly we have the old data that from U.S. News and World Report type of things with selectivity and the graduation rates and the student-faculty ratios and things of that nature, but it really doesn't always translate into what happens post-college.
Catherine, have you visited any schools yet?
Yes, I visited 3 colleges so far.
And is there anything about them that just kind of seduces and charms you and makes all of your, I'm going to take a hard look at this place, all those instincts, just they go out the window because you see some nice library or an athletic field or I don't know. How do the schools charm you?
Well, they'll always mention the studying abroad. That one's always a popular one. And they always show the typical pictures of students with throwing frisbees on the quads and showing the freshman dorms. Those are usually the hard selling points for the colleges I have seen.
Welcome to our utopia, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Guidance counselors tell us that they're frustrated with the various ranking programs, even the ones that your dad just mentioned, the U.S. News and World Report rankings, because they create a false sense that there's only 10 decent schools and the rest are, for losers, and that makes it very, very difficult to present a wide range of options for the very diverse students graduating these days. What do you think the federal government could do to simplify this process? Catherine, and then I'll talk to your dad.
Well, I think it'd be good to take a more overall approach when it comes to the colleges to see if it's really what is the best, I don't want to say deal, but almost what's the most all-inclusive, the best overall. Because, of course, the education has to be very strong, the programs have to be strong, but you also have to take into account cost and other factors.
Dr. Dura.
I feel that, as I said, there's be beneficial to have better measures of some sort, and also, in that sense, also an accountability for the colleges. So an objective measure or objective scale would be welcomed. It wouldn't be the end-all, but it'd certainly be another factor, I think, in consideration.
Well, Dr. Dura, it sounds like your daughter is college-bound.
I think so.
You got that going for you.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Grades are staying pretty good there, Catherine?
Thus far, yes.
Test scores okay?
Yep.
And are your parents on your case a lot right now these months?
I would say so, yes.
I would say so, yes. Well, have a great rest of the summer, because this year is going to be something.
Thank you. I'll try to enjoy it.
Catherine Dura and Dr. Paul Dura talking to us about their view of the college entrance experience as the president arrives in their community. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
President Obama this week tried to see things from the student perspective. Most students, he says, are not like our new friend Catherine in Binghamton.
One of the problems we found is that a lot of students, because in part they're not well informed, they're taking out a lot of loans, but they're not thinking through how fast they need to graduate. They never graduate. They can't pay back the loans. That means the taxpayer is getting stuck and the young person is no better off than they would have been. They're worse off.
How are you evaluating all of this from well outside the White House ivory tower?
My name is Sheila. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. And as a non-traditional college student, I looked at the schools that had the elementary program available and then the cost. And last, I looked at the class size. I never really focused on the rank, though.
And Chris in Poolsville, Maryland, shares his ranking. Number one, does the school offer a good education in your desired program of study? Number two, is it cost-effective? Number three, how does the school rank overall? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and be a part of the conversation. Find us, too, at facebook.com/thetakeaway. So a real cliffhanger yesterday for stock traders. The NASDAQ went down. A technological glitch brought trading to a halt for more than 3 hours on Thursday. That's what they're telling us anyway. It broke a record for a non-disaster-induced outage, which can only mean that the NASDAQ's computers are more than capable of creating their own self-induced disasters. Nathaniel Popper has been covering this for our partner, The New York Times. Welcome.
Good to be here.
So it seemed like they were very, very nervous over there at the NASDAQ, even though things seemed to work out pretty well. What's the explanation?
Well, the technical explanation is that the data feed through which everyone else gets the prices of stock trades went down. And that slender line, that data feed itself, was enough to bring down all trading in over 3,000 stocks.
And it just means that you can't be sure of the price. And if you can't be sure of the price, everything shuts down.
That's pretty much the shape of it.
How does data assure people that the number that they're seeing is real? Because as we saw yesterday, once that stops, it's all noise.
It does say a lot about the power of a number and the degree to which we rely on those decimal points. And that's really what happened here. People didn't know what exact price the last trade had happened at, and so they couldn't figure out what exact price to make the next trade happen at.
And, you know, if you're talking about real estate, it's sort of annoying if you can't get the price of the house that last sold on your block and you just wait around till somebody tells you. In this case, trades are taking place in matters of like tenths of a second.
Tenths of a second is would be the slowest investors out here. I mean, we've gotten down to millionths of a second. And I think that's a lot of what we found out yesterday is just how vulnerable our system has become because of the high-speed nature of it. And it's not just due to the speed. It's due to the incredible competition to stay up with that speed by all the players in the market. So NASDAQ, New York Stock Exchange, all of these players, the banks, are having to constantly change their software in order to keep up with the high speed of the market. And we're hearing a lot of complaints about that competition and how brittle that has made the system, how fragile it's made the system.
The SEC will be looking into this?
They were on a phone call all day yesterday with executives from NASDAQ and executives from the other exchanges. But certainly one of the things that I kept thinking about yesterday as this was happening was all the other technological breakdowns that have happened that not too different from this one, in which we've heard this is going to be the, you know, the call to action. This is going to be the come to Jesus moment. You know, this is going to be the time at which regulators in the industry finally get together and figure out a way to solve this. And inevitably, 3 months later, 5 months later, sometimes 3 days later, in the case of this week, we have another big technological glitch like this.
Maybe it's a come to Best Buy moment, not a come to Jesus moment. Nathaniel Popper is a reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Something new may be complicating further the domestic surveillance mission over at the high-tech NSA. A powerful solar storm that erupted earlier this week, a coronal mass ejection, astronomers call it, of millions of tons of charged particles hurtling towards Earth. They could be responsible for interference or even a complete shutdown of some space-based communications and spy systems. Professor Richard Harrison has been tracking the solar storm. He's chief scientist at the Space Science Department of the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory in Oxfordshire, England. He says Earth is about to be hosed down by a big magnet.
You're looking at a big magnetic cloud. So if you imagine a whole bunch of charged particles traveling out into space, and I'm talking about a billion tons here, but as a huge cloud carrying magnetic field with it. It's like a magnet traveling out through space. And we live on a magnet, don't we? The Earth is a magnet, and it's the interaction of those magnetic fields that actually cause problems for us. So it's like the impact of that magnetic field carried in that cloud, literally engulfing the Earth. That's the kind of thing that happens. And it looks so this one will just sort of graze through it, as it were. It possibly, in this case, won't have a huge effect.
All right. But still, I'm trying to get my head around the image that you're creating here. We've got a high-energy magnetic gas basically hosing down the Earth. Okay, maybe it's a glancing blow, but I know what magnets do to the little stripe on the credit cards. This could wreak havoc with what sorts of communication networks?
Well, actually, just to step back slightly, we have a view from a spacecraft called Stereo, two spacecraft called Stereo, the NASA spacecraft, and the two instruments we run through here, we lead them, called heliospheric images. What you can see is a cloud like this traveling out through space. The Earth is one pixel.
Wow.
And the clouds are huge. I mean, they literally pass right over the top of us. You know, you've got to use that information to try to predict that they're actually going to pass over us. You can't then say from those, oh, it's going to cause this particular effect. We're learning how to do that, if you like. But it's that magnetic field hitting our magnetic field that causes disruption to communication systems, power distribution systems, spacecraft, and so on. So it sounds sort of almost irrelevant, you know, this sort of cloud passing over the Earth as though it's a sort of ghostly effect. But it does have impact on us.
And that can include, you know, surveillance satellites, communication satellites, space-based communications of all kinds, networks, grids.
Yes, it can. It can cause disruption to GPS signals. It can cause, well, problem for a spacecraft. You could lose a spacecraft, potentially. If these clouds travel out fast enough, and this event might even be fast enough for that, you can get a shock at the front. In fact, almost certainly in this case. So if it hits you head on, you could get streams of really energetic particles flying out in front of these events. It's nice to get indoors, as it were.
Well, I'm glad to be blanketed by the atmosphere, as I'm sure you are. Richard Harrison, are we absolutely certain, I mean absolutely certain, that this eruption was not caused by Edward Snowden in any way?
Interesting question. No, it wasn't. These are natural. They've always been happening. They always will happen.
But would they maybe disrupt and shield us from some domestic surveillance if it messes up some of those surveillance satellites?
That's an interesting question. I mean, and part of the answer to that is, of course, it would. I mean, there are clearly times when these events really do cause significant disruption to signals and spacecraft and so on. So these things can happen. They do happen. They will happen.
Professor Richard Harrison, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Chief scientist at the Space Science Department of the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory in Oxfordshire, England, watching that eruption this week from the sun. If there was a microphone you could dangle over the comments page at the Huffington Post, you would hear a stadium full of voices. Civil mostly, loud yes, and some nasty. 270,000 comments on the Huffington Post every day. Even those comments are selected by algorithms and human curators, but the Post announced this week that anonymous comments are no longer welcome. Arianna Huffington, president, founder, and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post Media Group, says the site has attracted more than 260 million comments since it launched in 2005. And she wants her site to promote civil conversation. Anonymity, she says, gets in the way of that.
There were many trigger moments. There was my being in London and seeing what was happening with anonymity there, which had reached just incredible levels with death threats and rape threats. And I had a conversation with Brian Appleyard, who writes for the Sunday Times. And we had this conversation about anonymity and freedom of expression. And we all kind of defend anonymity on the grounds that it's freedom of expression. And Brian was very eloquent on the subject that, in fact, the two things are not at all identical, that freedom of expression, as he said today in a blog he wrote in the Times, requires a kind of moral agency. And if you're going to be anonymous and hide behind anonymity, you're really forfeiting your right, at least on our side. And while that was going on, at the Huffington Post itself, from the beginning, as you know, John, we put a tremendous premium on maintaining a civil conversation. All our comments from day one, when we had like 12 comments, were pre-moderated. And when our comments grew dramatically, we added the most advanced technology to moderate them, an algorithm that we keep educating and investing a lot in, plus 40 comment moderators. So we made a big investment in maintaining a civil environment. But as our comments kept growing, we've now had a total of over 260 million comments on the site. it became clear that the in order to maintain the kind of civil environment for conversations that we want, we would need to end anonymity. We realized that ending anonymity does not mean ending negative commenting, but it does mean substantially reducing it.
Can't that same argument against anonymity apply to anonymous sources that journalists use all the time, that if you don't have your identity disclosed, you lose a sense of moral agency?
No, not at all, because anonymous sources are not anonymous to the journalist to whom they talk. Whistleblowers are not anonymous to the journalist to whom they talk. And so that's a completely different situation. And of course, we are very much in favor of anonymous sources, provided, again, that anonymity is justified. As you know, anonymous sources have been dramatically misused also, as they were in the lead up to the war in Iraq.
So how do you determine someone's identity to the satisfaction that, you know, people can hide behind all kinds of digital identities, and anonymity just changes its disguise?
Well, we are going to be using a Facebook login, which is a pretty good system where people have to basically identify themselves. Our current users are going to be grandfathered in and then be able to continue commenting as they are, unless they use ad hominem attacks or a comment that would not be allowed, in which case they would have to identify themselves through a Facebook login.
You know, there's something about the power of digital media and the numbers and scale of digital media that brings out the worst in some people. Do you think on some level, I don't know what you imagined when you got into this, that you have created a monster here on some level?
I think it's anonymity that brings out the worst in people. We see that again and again. As we've moved from the adolescent stage of the internet to its more mature stage, where I believe we are in now, and we need to get deeper and deeper into it, we are actually going to make a lot of decisions like that. I mean, curation, ending anonymity, all these things are just ways basically to reduce the level of noise.
But is it possible that a comment from someone who's, say, in a situation that is politically sensitive in Iran, who wants to get a message out about something going on in Iran or in Aleppo in Syria, is going to suddenly be blocked on the Huffington Post because of this?
Oh, we have so many ways for people like that to reach us, you know, emails to our reporters. There are so many ways, direct tweets. If you go on the Huffington Post and want to reach one of the reporters or to comment anonymously about something going on, you're going to find the endless array of ways to reach us. And of course, commenting is not the only way our readers engage with our content. You know, they share, they tweet, they post to LinkedIn, they post to Google+, they email their friends. And these are all actions they take publicly, you know, in full view of the internet public, with their full identity.
So, Arianna Huffington, I'm fascinated that on your first day, did you really have 12 comments, as you just mentioned before? That's actually a huge amount for a first day.
Well, what I do remember, John, is that I had to get my daughters to agree to be paid like some below minimum wage to pre-moderate comments in the early 80s of the Huffington Post, because there are only five of us, and we certainly didn't have time to pre-moderate comments. And again, from the beginning, that was so important, especially, you remember, as we were trying to elevate blogging and to invite people who would never have dreamt of blogging before to blog, we had a real responsibility to make sure they were not being attacked for no reason.
Well, it sounds like even from the very beginning, you had enough comments to have plenty of work.
At least for my two middle school daughters.
Arianna Huffington, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Arianna Huffington is president and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post Group.
Hey, what happened?
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read
if they can't even fit inside the building?
I'm freaking out, man.
If you blow chunks and she comes back, she's yours.
El Deuterino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
Fat, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life, son.
Lebowski, Zoolander. Yes, it's movie day here on The Takeaway. Lights, camera, action. For Kristen Meinzer, doing it solo this week. Rafer Guzman on vacation. Kristen Meinzer, of course, co-hosts the Movie Day podcast and is a culture producer here at The Takeaway. Welcome, Kristen.
Happy Friday, John.
So we've got three very different movies, it seems to me. The first one, Spectacular Now, from the makers of 500 Days of Summer, which I like to call the 500 Years of Summer. Slowest movie in the universe, but my kids just love it. Spectacular Now. Let's see her clip.
Do you live around here, Sutter?
How do you know my name?
You go to the same school. You wouldn't know who I am.
I know you.
I'm Amy. Amy Finicky.
That's what I was going to say.
Is this about superficial people who do nothing endlessly in a movie?
Oh, John, I can't even tell how you feel about 500 Days of Summer based on that. No, this is about two teenage kids. We have the very popular boy who we just heard there, Sutter, who is cocky. He's an alcoholic. He dates a lot. He goes to parties. And he meets this girl, Amy, who is an overachiever in school, kind of a wallflower, not exactly popular, but kind of on a rebound. He starts a relationship with her and he realizes that maybe she's too good for him despite everything he thought initially, and he's such a self-defeating guy that he might not be able to make it work. It's actually a really great movie. I highly recommend it.
So it's a redemption movie for a guy who really hasn't thought ambitiously about his future and meets somebody who helps him to think that way.
It might not be about redemption. It might be about failure and realizing you can possibly redeem yourself. It's not as tidy as all that.
Yeah, I guess failure is more popular than success these days in the movies for that generation. All right, you're next. What's this? This is scary. This seems like a scary movie, but I can't tell from the ads.
I will say it's scary, it's funny, and it's really, really gross.
And it sounds like this.
Why would anybody do this? They've been watching us for days. This wasn't a random attack.
Who's the they who's been watching? What kinds of things are attacking here?
We have a filthy, rich family that's getting together in the country at their estate, and they're dysfunctional. They fight. They yell. And then suddenly their home is invaded. It's a home invasion nightmare.
By
I can't
zombies?
Tell you. I can't
oh,
tell
on.
You. I'm not going to tell you. But I will say that it's a very funny movie. They continue to fight and to bicker even after they've been impaled by screwdrivers and have weapons sticking out of their chest.
Impaled screwdrivers. Well, so it's not termites they're invading.
It's masked invaders. And I will say there's a kitchen murder scene that's unlike anything I've ever seen before.
Funny,
gross, scary,
and
all of the above.
You liked this.
I really liked this movie, yeah.
Two out of three. All right, The World's End, tell me about this.
This is about a guy who gets together his old high school gang. He's now in his mid-40s. He wants to complete the pub crawl that he never was able to finish with his buddies back in high school.
Sounds like a job for a Simon Pegg.
Tonight, we will be partaking of a liquid repast as we wend our way up the Golden Mile, commencing with an inaugural tankard in the first post, then onto the old familiar, the famous cock, the cross hands, the good companions, the trusty servant, the two-headed dog, the mermaid, the beehive, the king's head, and the hole in the wall for a measure of the same, all before the last bittersweet pint in that most fateful terminus, the World's End.
Sounds like our executive producer's vacation last year.
It's actually a lot of fun at times because Simon Pegg, Edgar Wright, and team from Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead, they have such great chemistry together. But unfortunately, the movie also is weighed down a little bit by extraterrestrial robots that make an appearance in this movie.
Basically a 2 out of 3 there. World's End, You're Next, and Spectacular Now. Kristen Meinzer, thanks.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
You
Kristen
too.
Meinzer, co-host of the Movie Day podcast and culture producer for our program. Voting is the ultimate data crunch of democracy. Assuring the right to vote assures the quality of that data. And changing the way we vote potentially changes the data set that constitutes our democracy. So on some level, the whole notion of voting rights requires a data cruncher, as well as activists and lawyers, to help us all understand the implications of this year's Supreme Court decision, Shelby County versus Holder, that struck down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. As part of our voting rights tour of America, we wanted to get a data cruncher's view of the significance of some of the changes in voting laws we've already seen in North Carolina, Florida, and Texas. Dante Chinney is the director of the American Communities Project at American University and our favorite number cruncher. Dante, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
How do you take a look at the kinds of changes and the kinds of dynamics that are going on in some of these locations, and I'm speaking of North Carolina, Florida, and Texas, that could really affect turnout, that could have an impact on an election coming up?
Well, what I've been doing and what I did is really for the last couple of months been looking at this, and I looked at two things in the last election. I looked at what the registered voter turnout was, and I looked at the 18 and over turnout. You know, and when you do this, a couple of things really jump out. First of all, when you look at Florida, Texas, and North Carolina, turnout in Texas, particularly 18 and over turnout, but turnout really across the board, was down. And it was down in part because nobody campaigned in Texas. Texas is more or less an uncontested state in presidential years, so people don't bother doing a whole heck of a lot there. But the other thing that's really interesting when you look at the numbers is there are real differences within these types. So some places you just always get higher turnout. And one of these places where you get much higher turnout is actually ex-urban places. And that goes back to something we talked about when this ruling first came down from the Supreme Court about Shelby County. This is the original Supreme Court case was focused on Shelby County, and they talked about how Alabama had changed because look how Shelby County had changed. Well, Shelby County clearly had changed. We talked about that. But these ex-urban places that have seen rapid growth and rapid change are the kind of places where you get big turnout. So if you were just to look at what's going on in ex-urban counties, you'd say, well, my gosh, there's no problem in any of these places. Look at the turnout you get, not just registered voter turnout, but 18 and over turnout. People in these places, they come out to vote.
So exurbs, we're talking about places far from, you know, major cities, so they don't qualify as suburbs, but they have a lot of growth, a lot of diversity, and you're saying are pretty atypical if you're trying to generalize about the entire state.
Yeah, I think so. I think they're very atypical because they're the kind of places where both campaigns fight. And I think even when it's not a presidential campaign, a gubernatorial race, a House race, people are fighting for these places and spending a lot of money and time in them for a bunch of reasons. One is that rapid growth means there are more and more voters there, and you want to kind of make your imprint and kind of grab that community. So turnout is a lot higher there. But if you go to other places in these, you go to other types of community, Hispanic centers, which is a type we look at, and these places we call the African-American South, the turnout is much lower. The 18 and over turnout is much lower, much, much lower. And the Hispanic centers, turnout is by far the lowest. Now, some people would say, well, that might be because those places have more illegal immigrants who can't vote. It's like, well, you'd have to really do more research to figure that out, and that may be part of it. Some of it may be a language barrier. But the turnout is, without question, when you look at the numbers, there's enough to suggest that these places are different. They're fundamentally different. Something's going on here.
All right. So a couple of takeaways here. Number one, and really interesting one, is this idea that Shelby County, because it's an exurb, is absolutely not the kind of community you'd want to generalize about whether pre-clearance should be suspended throughout the South.
Absolutely right. Yes.
And number two, in places where this voter turnout is still pretty low, the healthy dynamics of Shelby County are completely absent, which means that the shenanigans where you can shave votes here, there, and the other place, they work better in low turnout kinds of districts. Yes?
That's absolutely true. Yeah, without question.
Dante Chinney is the director of the American Communities Project at American University. And all this week and last, we reached out repeatedly to the attorneys general in Texas, North Carolina, and Florida and their governors. They all declined to participate or did not respond to our requests. We did, however, talk to the Solicitor General of Alabama, John Neiman. He wrote an amicus brief in support of Shelby County, Alabama. He said that the Supreme Court's ruling was a message to Congress.
If you think that it's sufficiently important to distinguish between states in this way, you need to come up with a formula that accounts for current realities.
What are the current realities where you vote? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. A memory of when voting was not a right, but was more a racial quiz show.
I have to say that I failed the voter registration test 3 times when I was in college. I couldn't pass the literacy test.
College-educated Joyce Ladner remembering how hard it was for her to vote as an African-American back in the 1960s. This week, we've taken you on a voting rights tour looking at what's changed and what will change now that the Supreme Court decision in Shelby County versus Holder permits districts to enact all kinds of changes to voting. Joyce Ladner was an activist who fought for the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s. Next week on our program, you'll hear her remembrances of the March on Washington, which turns 50 this year. But she was one of the activists who met all of the voting restrictions with organizing campaigns that got people to the polls and eventually got the Voting Rights Act passed in 1965. Marvin Randolph, you might say, is a Joyce Ladner of our era. He's been revamping his get-out-the-vote strategies in light of the Supreme Court's voting rights decision. Marvin Randolph is the senior vice president for campaigns at the NAACP, and he sees the Shelby County versus Holder case as both a hurdle and an opportunity.
Over the course of history, there always have been some challenges to the Voting Rights Act where people have tried to dismantle it, weaken it, water it down. And when we were fighting a lot of the voting rights attacks last year during the election, we did fight them in the courts where we brought challenge over a variety of laws that were bad around voter ID, around early voting, people that were trying to do things to actively suppress the vote. We also fought it in the court of public opinion, educating people about what the rules and laws were, which is part of why in 2012, when people thought the turnout would be lower than it was in 2008, and it was actually higher because we educated people in the community on what these laws were, how to counter them, and if we couldn't beat them in the courts or we couldn't beat them by organizing people in the streets, we had to organize and out-organize people at the polls. And so that employed a lot of techniques on Election Day and leading up to Election Day, not just doing things to make sure that people like my mother came out to vote a week early so that her vote was not infringed upon, but also making sure that when people were in line on Election Day, that they got texts that told them how to stay in that line and what the rules were in that line and how to get help if they had a problem in that line. And as a result, early vote was 12% higher than it was in 2008. As a result, you had people that stood in line for 8 hours. The backlash had a backlash. And we actually saw a turnout that was increased, with the African-American vote being 8% higher than it was even in the historic year of 2008. And we're really proud of that.
All right. So let me give you some of the changes that we've already seen since Shelby County versus Holder. And tell me your sense of the countermeasures. Number one, maps that were declared improper during the preclearance period, redistricting maps, congressional maps. How do you counter that?
Yeah, so there are places like Texas that literally hours after the Supreme Court decision began to institute redistricting maps that were invalidated under the previous Voting Rights Act. And so we continue to fight those battles in the courts, but also there are parts of the Voting Rights Act that allow us to fight things in different ways. There's Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act where you can target some bad behavior that people are doing under a different section of the Voting Rights Act. So our legal team is using the other parts of the Voting Rights Act where there are tools. There are places like North Carolina that has an incredibly draconian law that does everything from cutting early vote to eliminating same-day registration to eliminating the provision that says, and when people are turning 18 before the election, they can vote early. And so we have to fight that with other parts of the Voting Rights Act and fight that legally in the courts.
So let's talk about voter IDs. How do you mobilize on a grassroots level to make sure everyone has the proper papers that they're going to need as these voter ID laws get changed?
Well, it's interesting you say that because, you know, one of the things that's true about the last election year when people talked about how turnout was still high in spite of rules like voter ID, it was because, you know, the NAACP and groups like us knew a year and a half that these attacks were happening. And so we educated people in the community about what types of IDs they had to have, even if you couldn't change the law. You know, it's very interesting that in Texas, you can use a gun ID to register to vote, but you can't use a student ID. It really questions what message we're sending to our youth about what's really important. And we have to raise awareness of that in the courts and in the court of public opinion. But we also have to make sure that we educate those students so they understand what they need so that they can have the proper type of ID, whatever state ID is required to be able to vote.
But you're not telling students to go get guns down in Texas.
No, that's that would be the exact opposite message. But there are a number of other types of IDs that people can use. It is, in essence, a version of what we believe is very much like a poll tax. You know, if you have to go to the DMV to get a particular type of ID, you have to have the right papers to be able to get that ID. You have to have the time to get that ID. And I don't know the last time you've been to DMV, but it never was a quick trip for me. And, you know, and being able to take off work to be able to do that is something that certain communities and certain demographics and certain income levels can't do. And the opposition knows that. that's why they pass these types of IDs. It's not because of any of the other things they allege. It's because they know that it's going to make it more difficult for other people to turn out and vote. So we have to do like what we did in Pennsylvania, where we got some student IDs to be validated to make sure that people could use IDs that were available to them. So we'll continue to wage those fights.
What about purges like in Florida? How do you make a voter purge proof using your tools and techniques?
You know, we have to fight these battles in the legislature at the federal level and at the state level, particularly at the states where a lot of these activities go on. And what you will find is that with an army of over 1 million registered voters, a lot of these legislative districts don't have a lot of folks in them. And if you mobilize them, you can actually institute real change. And that's why a lot of the tactics that we're employing, like in places like North Carolina, where you've heard about the Moral Mondays, where people have been using civil disobedience to raise awareness about the issue so that legislators are shamed into doing the right thing or pressured to do the right thing. Those types of organizing tactics we continue to bring to the fore, much like what we saw historically during the civil rights movement, which is interesting given the fact that we're approaching the 50-year anniversary of the March on Washington, which was predicated on civil disobedience, on the cornerstones of the Civil Rights Act and what this movement was about.
Marvin Randolph, Senior Vice President for Campaigns at the NAACP, thanks so much.
Thank you.
To see an image of a voting ballot in 1964 and the race between Lyndon Johnson and Barry Goldwater, visit our website at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, a journey through the civil rights movement of the 1960s, the March on Washington, stories from people who were there and at other moments of the 1960s. That's coming up next on The Takeaway. On the morning of August 28, 1963, the idea of America was tested. And in the sounds of feet stepping and buses parking around Washington, D.C., there was a sign early that day that something was about to happen.
The Inspector Douglas of the police department has reported that north of K Street, it appears just as it would on a Sunday in Washington. And Sergeant Liskey reports that the bus traffic in and around the Baltimore Parkway is about normal, and bus movement within the city of Washington is normal.
It would not stay that way. A normal day. This would be no normal day in Washington, in America, or the world.
Freedom, freedom.
For hours, the crowds gathered. A promised march on Washington, D.C. was being fulfilled. A promised march to speak of the unfulfilled promises in the U.S. Constitution. It was a grassroots event, the first of its kind national news event in America.
The singing of the national anthem from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial opens the official program now for a two-hour program this afternoon.
The speeches from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial would pull no punches. This one by activist, now U.S. Congressman John Lewis, was nearly banned.
I appeal to all of you to get in this great revolution that is sweeping this nation. Get in and stay in the streets of every city until the revolution of 1776 is complete. For in the Delta of Mississippi, in Southwest Georgia, in the Black Belt of Alabama, in Harlem, in Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia, and all over this nation, the black mass is on the march for jobs and freedom.
A march for jobs and freedom and so much more. The 250,000 people who came to the mall 50 years ago next week brought their hopes and dreams of change and the changes they'd already made in their own communities. Whether they made it to the march or not, their work was all a piece of the grand church of moral change being built brick by brick in America, and especially on that mall. Carrie Young had made her difference in Arkansas, teaching people to read.
We realized that people couldn't read or write, so we got one of the churches to allow us to teach people how to read and write, and specifically to learn how to sign their name so when it came time to vote, they could register. One of the things that came up was the white community was trying to force people to have to fill an application out, which is where that voter education application came from. And so things like that we had to change around because we'd get word that the white Klan or whatever they call themselves, they would wait till it got dark and try to come through there and bring physical harm to the different ones.
We are tired. We are tired of being beaten by policemen. We're tired of seeing our people lock up in jail over and over again. And then you holler, be patient. How long can we be patient? We want our freedom, and we want it now.
All of the people at the March on Washington carried a mission and sets of memories of attempts to march and confront authority, some that hadn't gone peacefully. John Lewis's impatience was an energy he took to a march in Montgomery, Alabama, the very next year, remembered here by protester and doctor to the injured protesters, Alfred Moldovan.
There were people streaming across a bridge, crying, limping, injured. I remember John Lewis had been beaten on the head and had a concussion. He was sent to the hospital. I crossed. I was the only one that crossed the bridge and got to the other side, went into houses to drag people out, you know, who had been gassed. I can still smell the gas, the shoes and the things laying on the side, and the goons with their clubs lining the road, you know, along with the National Guard. A horrible scene. And Dr. King came and said he would go again. And this time we marched to the edge of the bridge and knelt and prayed. That was the second march.
A chant begins, more applause. Women are waving handkerchiefs, hands are waving as they greet Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
Even though it was festive on the Washington Mall in August of 1963, the sense that anything could happen was on the faces, in the hearts, and in the minds and memories. Everyone knew the stakes at this march. Many of them would feel the power of white society's unwillingness to just give freedom without a fight. That realization came to Freeman Hrabowski just weeks after the March on Washington.
And we're in church that Sunday in September. The pastor gets a note and tells us that our sister church, where relatives and of sons and daughters and fathers and mothers had been bombed. I thought back to different friends, Cynthia, and I'd seen her on Friday, and I've said this before. She said, "Bye, Freeman." And I knew she went to that church. One of the girls had been given a ring that morning by her father, and they were not able to find her, and then found that hand with that ring. We had nightmares for years. And I'll never forget the three coffins with the nieces, the youngest of the three, I think she was 11, McNair, in the middle, smaller. I'd never seen a coffin that small. People who were the naysayers were saying, that church was bombed, those girls were in those coffins because we went to jail. We upset things. And that's what happens. These were blacks saying that. And here's Dr. King back. And he looked into the faces of those parents and said, life is as hard as steel. As hard as steel. I'll tell you what gave me hope in the midst of the darkness. It was the first time I had seen whites in my church. There were rabbis and priests and Baptist ministers. It was amazing. And they cried.
50 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. But 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination.
So many symbols in that march on Washington 50 years ago. Far beyond the single plea for peace that has become the caption of this image of history, a caption written by Martin Luther King, Jr.
My poor little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
The march started something 50 years ago that's still going on today, thanks to New Vision, New Voices, funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting for making these oral histories available to us, and WGBH, Boston Public Radio, for their contributions. All next week, we'll be paying tribute to the March on Washington 50 years ago with voices from some of the people who helped to organize the march.
Dr. King's message really helped me to know that I could fight and still not be violent, that I could fight with my mind and with my energies to have people learn how to respect each other and themselves.
Your memories of the March on Washington, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.